At Life and Leadership with Bobby Kerr, we're all about celebrating the journey of life and leadership, no matter what stage you're at. And that's where our partners at Standard Life come in. For decades, Standard Life have been helping people navigate life's most important transitions, from planning your financial future to embracing the opportunities that come with a new chapter in life. Whether you're starting your career or nearing retirement, Standard Life is there. Working with financial advisors, they help you plan for your life journey and do it with confidence. Because getting you ready for your best second life involves financial planning, but it's also about making sure you're ready to live it well. So wherever you are at in your life or career, let Standard Life help you plan for tomorrow while enjoying today. Visit standardlife.ie to find out more about planning for your best second life. Standard Life International DAC is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland.
Life and Leadership with Bobby Kerr.
A News Talk original.
Brought to you by Standard Life. Retirement specialists getting you ready for your second life.
Now, my guest today on Life and Leadership is David McRedmond. He's the CEO of OnPost. He was previously head of TV3 and Aircom and started life in the book trade. He's had a reputation for getting things done. We chat to him today in the Jewel, in the OnPost Crown, that is the new headquarters in the Exo building down here at Dublin Docklands. Hello, David.
Good morning.
Firstly, let's talk about our surroundings. And just for our listeners, we're perched here on the corner of a building. I don't know what floor we're on, but we have the most magnificent view of the Docklands, the Liffey, and back in towards the city.
It's
a majestic location.
It is. It's a wonderful location. We're really blessed to be here. What's interesting about it for us is, because everybody thought we leave the GPO, will we lose some of our soul? Whereas this is actually much closer to where the Postal Service started, which was around Sheriff Street. And also, when we look out the window, we see all the ships with all the containers, which is our business now.
Yeah.
OnPost is now essentially an e-commerce delivery business. That's the core of what OnPost is in one direction. We then look in the other direction up the river and we see all the financial services and banks, and that's the other business in terms of our post office business is now very heavily becoming a banking business. It's a place where you can do your daily banking. And indeed, we have our own financial services products. So it's quite fitting to be here. I love it.
Right. We'll come back to that in a minute. We've lots to talk about in OnPost. But en route to OnPost, David, there's a lot to chat about. Tell us about your early years in South Dublin. You know, your father worked in RT, maybe more of that a bit later. But you grew up in South Dublin, I believe. You went and studied modern Irish history in UCD. What sort of a young fellow were you?
Lazy.
Right.
I met a school friend. They said, we never thought anything would come of you. I met him the other day. And I was also relatively quiet. I grew up in a very busy household in Dundrum. And my brother and sisters, they were quite loquacious. And I was the quiet one in the house. And to a degree reserved. So I had a happy childhood. I loved Dundrum. I still love Dundrum. There's something about a great kind of democratic feel to it. And I went to school in Gonzaga. My father had been to a Jesuit school, so he was determined I should go. And I enjoyed that by and large. But, I would say, and then university in those days was really not something to shout home about,
yeah.
Because we lived at home. I didn't have the money to be living away from. So I lived at home. I'd walk into UCD, into Belfield, and And that's not much of a university career. So, and I did a master's. Funnily enough, I stayed there 5 years, and I did my master's in history. Now, the funny thing about that is my master's thesis was on Dublin in the 19th century. And then last year, I was asked by the Taoiseach to chair a task force in Dublin. So I think these things get embedded in you. So I'm not saying I got a good education. I'm grateful for that at university, but it wasn't particularly happy time.
Yeah, and for fellas like me who were up from the country, it was the great liberator.
Yeah.
Well, my liberator.
Exactly. And for me and for people like me, the great liberation was London.
Right.
And I left. There were no jobs. I went to London after university. And the next few years in London were probably the most fun years of my life. And that was the great liberation. And that was proper living. And, I lived in a cupboard for the first year in a flat. And it was a really great time and made great friends there. And I joined Waterstones.
Yeah, your early career there was, basically you were working on the floor. Had you an interest in books that led you to Waterstones? Or was it just there happened to be a job there?
Very much happened to be a job there. I had been in London for 6 weeks. I hadn't got a job. I'd run out of money. And I thought I was going to be like a producer in the BBC or an editor in the Times or something like that. And in the end, I'd run out of money. I remember actually having to walk to my interview. I was living in Notting Hill, which then was not as it is today, but walking from there into Mayfair to my interview with Tim Waterstone. And so I was thrilled when I got a job. And yeah. It was the second Waterstones bookstore. And I became great friends with Tim and with a gang of people and built that company into something really special.
And Tim sent you to America to represent Waterstones.
That's right.
What was the job? What did that job actually involve?
It involved getting on a plane and getting off at the other end in Boston and working out what to do. Because he said, just open Waterstones in the States. And that was it. So I got in the plane. I think I was about 29 or so, and 30. I got in the plane and that started looking around, and eventually found one or two people to work with. And we opened a magnificent bookstore in Back Bay in Boston.
I know it, yeah.
And it was fantastic. It was really everything I wanted to do. And the funny thing was I remember hiring the booksellers and interviewing them, and we always took great pride in Waterstones and the quality of staff we got. And in America, I think I was hiring 15, and I think I took the first 15 people, because Americans are trained to do interviews and they come across as so impressive. They blew me away. And then they all started, and some of them weren't that good.
Waterstones was taken over, I think, by W.H. Smith, and it gave you another opportunity with that business.
Yeah, it was taken over by W.H. Smith, and I came back to the UK, and I ran Waterstones in the UK and Ireland as the operations director, and that was really the start of my business career, I would say. And then W.H. Smith sold Waterstones. They did phenomenally well out of it. But they wouldn't let me go. They wanted me to work with them. And they said, no, you're not going. You're not part of the sale. And they put me in charge of railway station stores. I thought, this is... I could not believe it. I was distraught. I was absolutely devastated. I remember going to the railway station saying, you got to be kidding, looking at this.
They can be grim places.
Grim. And I eventually, my wife told me to get over myself and to stop feeling sorry for myself. And after about 3 months, I was also based down in Swindon. So I was driving down to Swindon every day. It was really miserable. But as always in business, you just need to find people around you. And I got a few people from W.H. Smith, and we created a team. We were the kind of ugly ducklings. Nobody wanted to be part of this business. And this team was fantastic. And we, within a year, turned that business into a new business called Travel Retail. and which had its own supply chain, its own merchandising. And I did a big deal with Railtrack, who owned all the railway stations, did a big deal with British Airport Authority. And that became what WH Smith is now. Indeed, only in the last month, WH Smith has announced it's selling its high street stores, which were always the stores people wanted to be in, because its travel retail business is rocking. And I'm very proud of that. I mean, it was strategically, what became so clear was, you know, if you're in Paddington Station, you realize these commuters, they're commuting every day. They're going to be great readers, and they also need, you know, an apple for the journey or whatever. So you just get that right.
And by virtue of what they do, they're loyal because they're there every day.
They're loyal, and they're loyal if you make their journey better.
Yeah.
Nothing, you know, you get a good book to somebody. And I remember in More Stones, we had a book of the month, and I remember saying in W.H. Smith, there has to be a book of the week, because you'd read a book in a week when you commute. And that, you know, so you did simple things like that. There were, I remember one of the big problems was queues. There were always queues in the stores. And I was looking at the queues. Most people were just buying a newspaper. And I'm like, well, just put in an honesty box. And we were the first to do that. And put in an honesty box. And they'll go, well, what if they steal the newspaper? And go, well, they could steal the newspaper anyway. And it actually made money because newspapers were like, I can't remember, like 95 pence or something.
Yeah.
They put in a pound coin or something into the honesty box. So little small things, but then you've got to get the style of it right and just show you care for the customer.
You were headhunted, as you say, by Aircom then. I think it was around the year 2000, back to Ireland. Was it always your intention maybe to work your way back?
No, right. I don't think I ever really intended. I'd actually gone back to the United States with WH Smith and doing travel retail there. And our young family, we didn't really want to live in Atlanta. And we said, no, we'll move back. And I was going to find, in fact, my wife went back with the children. I was going to find a job in London following her. And then I got this call about Aircom. So that's how I ended up coming back here. And it was a huge shock coming back to Ireland. I mean, the business environment was... it was wild. It was feral, I would describe it. You know, it was, I just couldn't believe decisions being made on a whim, and very strong views people had and prejudices in this way and that way. I was absolutely stunned. And so it was, it was a fascinating period, but that kind of late Celtic Tiger was, they were heady days.
And Aircom in those days, remind us of where it was, I suppose, transitionally.
It had just floated. It had just been privatised when I joined. I joined like a couple of months after the privatisation. And it wasn't in any fit state to be privatised, to be honest. And it collapsed and it was taken over by private equity. And the private equity people were fine, and it was a consortium led by Tony O'Reilly, who I got very close to and was a great fan of. And, you know, the business made a lot of money, and we all made a lot of money in a few years, but it was miserable.
Yeah.
I really didn't enjoy it. I found it to be, I just found it very political, very tricky, and I found it very difficult that finance was always at the top of everything. And I'm thinking, you know, we're an important company and we're important to the state and there's customers. And
well, I think if you look
we let them down.
If you look at how many owners that business has essentially had, it's basically been led, has it not, by various financial consortiums.
It has, but...
And iterations.
It has, but, you know... Financial consortiums can be very good too. You know, it's now owned by NJJ, which is French private equity, and I was thrilled years later to be asked to go in as chairman of AIR, and I've just finished my term as chairman there.
You did three terms there.
Yeah, I've done three terms, so I'm term limited. But the French owners, private equity owners, are fantastic. I mean, we've gone from being a laggard in broadband to being one of the best countries in the world with fiber connectivity because of their approach. And they have a very simple approach. They said, we'll build a great mobile network, great 5G network. We'll build a great fixed line network, broadband network. And then we fill the pipe and people will come. And we won't spend one cent on anything else. They're famously mean, the owners. Don't spend one cent on anything else. We won't be distracted by anything else. And I take my hat off to them.
That's worked.
It's worked. And it's not just worked. It's made them money. It's made Air money. But most importantly, it's made Ireland money. It's really built out serious infrastructure. So in the end, maybe it took 20 years for that flotation to work, but in the end, the privatization has worked. And Ireland now has great connectivity, great networks, fantastic team of people in Air, and great credit to the French. So, you know, there's different forms of private equity. I think in the end, ultimately what it comes down to is the quality of management. And, you know, it's any private equity will tell you that the most important thing they do in a business is hire a CEO and CFO, you know, and if you get that right and then get a key team around them, then you stand a chance of being successful.
Which brings us on neatly to TV3. Mm. I think that was 2006, around that sort of time.
Yeah.
What attracted you to that? I know your father had worked in RT, your late sister also worked there.
That's right.
So there was some connectivity, was there not, even at an ideological level?
Absolutely. And also, you know, I like media, and I like that interface. I like that kind of public-private fault line. I think it's a really interesting space to be. But I'd left Aircom because it had been sold again, and I thought, okay, it's finally time to go. And it came up very quickly, this job. It was, again, private equity owned, and went into TV3. And TV3 was, I mean, that was a really plucky company. Yeah. You know, people were really young.
And people must remember as well, you know, it financially it was rocky, wasn't it?
It was rocky. And, well, you know, the first 2 years were great, and advertising was coming out our ears. And then in April of 2008, I was going, what's happened to advertising? And thought, we'll come back next month. And then May, I said, okay, we're in for a crash. And I remember that July, there was that kind of partnership pay deals that the government used to do. And they agreed a partnership pay deal. I remember having a huge row with IBEC about it, at 6%.
Yeah.
6% pay increase. I'm going, you're nuts. The world is going to collapse. You know, we could see it. And sure enough, by September, I had put in place a pay freeze. And by the end of that year, it was pay cuts. And it was redundancies. And we had a really tough few years getting through the global financial crash. But you know, those things learn you. You learn about cash. You learn about the importance of cash. You learn about the importance of banks. You learn about the importance of relationships. But I also learned that you've got to keep a vision. You know, you can't just say, oh, we're just going to survive. That's what it's about. It's not worth it.
Yeah.
How about not surviving and doing something else? That would be a better thing to do. So
we really have to do those kind of tough years around, you know, making people redundant, dealing with banks that are hostile, all that stuff. It sort of bloods you for success.
It completely does, and it also makes you very appreciative of success when it comes. And the great thing is, we held our nerve, and I credit again the shareholders for giving me the money, because I said in the middle of this, I said, I want to build a big studio. And so we built the HD studio right in the middle of the financial crash. And because our whole strategy was to make more Irish programming, and we stuck to our strategy, we built that studio, and that studio today is used so heavily.
Yeah.
And it is such a brilliant piece of infrastructure. And I remember it cost 5.5 million. It wasn't like, you know, I sometimes laugh when I hear RT saying, oh, it'll cost 150, 200 million to move or whatever. I'm like, no. We built a studio in Ballymount for 5.5 million. That was the biggest television studio in the country, because I made sure it was a meter bigger than the Late Show studio in my rare Trumpian moment.
We'll come to Ampost in a minute, but while we're talking about RTE, what about that famous interview that you did there? Again, for the Director General's role, you weren't shortlisted, to the surprise of many, given your credentials, given your experience, given your track record, and indeed given your interest in the job. When you reflect on that now, what was that all about?
Well, when I reflect on it, the amount of people who say to me, you dodged a bullet, is extraordinary. And I don't feel that way at all, because I mean, the only thing I feel is I'm really grateful to have been able to stay at Ampost and do Ampost, because this is a brilliant company and I love it. But, you know, the challenge at RTE is fantastic. I mean, who wouldn't want that? It's the, you know, it's the biggest brand in the country. It's not the best. Ampost is the best brand, but it's the biggest brand in the country. And I'd love to have gone in there. And also because in TV3, I could see where it's easy when you're competing with somebody to see where the faults are, but also to see where the good stuff is. And I also feel that RTE took one hell of a bashing all the time. And there wasn't really anybody standing up for RTE and promoting it and defending it.
So you could have been that guy.
I think I could have been. But and look, recruitment is always a slightly odd process, and I didn't mind. I was a bit cross that no one apologised to me for having made the most public hames of something that could have cost me my career here, and nobody apologised, and the headhunter didn't apologise, no one did anything. I remember one Sunday I had to put an end to it, and I said, because it was going on for about 3 weeks and it was in the newspapers, and so I just said, okay, I've had enough, I'm issuing a statement saying I'm not interested in the job, you've very good people for the job, get on, appoint them, do it, you know, and I issued that statement. So, but I think it's, you know, and I think Kevin Backhurst has gone in there and he certainly steadied the ship, and I think he does stand up for the organisation. Myself, I think RTE really needs to move on now. I mean, I think it's got stability, but now it needs to do something different. But so does every company. I mean, it's no company, not only is no company perfect, but I am a believer in that idea that all companies are dying, and they are all dying, and your job is to find the next life for the company. And that's the case, whatever industry you're in. I mean, look, you know, this week Danish post office announced they're not delivering any more letters, you know, so I'm in an industry now where, you know, the major revenue stream is disappearing.
And let's talk about that for a second, David, because when you arrived at Ampost, and I think, do you think it's important to have initial impact as the guy in charge, particularly when, as you say, this is a changing industry? So, you know, you probably in your first 3 months, you get an opportunity to do maybe one or two things that make significant impact. You put up the price of the stamp, which was put up, and I forget the numbers.
Well,
but it was significant.
I remember the numbers. I remember the numbers intimately. I came in, and it was clear there was no money in the company, had no cash. And but that's fine. You can have no cash as long as you've got growth or something in the future. Had no growth, had no cash. And I was thinking, and now it had a very good network. The previous manager had done a very good job building out the network, but it was going nowhere. So I went to government and I said, I threatened to put it into examinership. And they went berserk with me and they said, you can't put it in examinership. And they're going, well, what can we do to avoid it? And I said, remove the price cap. It was a price cap in the stamp. The price of the stamp was 72 cents. And I remember the board were arguing to get it up to 75 cents. So I put it up to a euro. And
which is 25% odd.
That was a massive increase. And that gave us the runway for 2 years, 2 to 3 years of revenue, which meant that we could then brought in McKinsey. We, as a team, I appointed a team, management team, and we designed a strategy. And thankfully, it's a strategy that's worked reasonably well. But you know, key to that is appointing a team and finding the right people. I found, and I often tell the story, I found a brilliant chief of staff, and she led the transformation. And actually, when I was thinking, because I was thinking last night about this interview with you, I was thinking, what really has made a difference? And I would genuinely say this in the late stage of my career. Actually, women have been really influential, women in business, because they take, there's no doubt there's a different approach. And I've really learned from that and really enjoy it. And I work with great men, you know, I work with a fantastic CFO in Peter Quinn. But actually, the difference for me has been working with very senior women and learning some of their style around how to do things. And I think that's really, it's quite interesting.
Life and Leadership with Bobby Kerr.
A News Talk original.
Brought to you by Standard Life, a life savings company for your journey to and through retirement.
When we talk about the changing, I suppose, business landscape within the post office, as you rightly say, the letter is over. You got to find new ways. Financial services is an interesting one in that I know that the agency work that the post office does for the banks has been a real success for you. And that's probably come about as a result of banks withdrawing from rural urban areas. And even the way when you see post offices going the same route. It's interesting that the closure of remote sites has resulted in opportunity for the business, albeit of a different kind.
It really has. And, you know, Bobby, I go back to your involvement. I remember in the post office when I came in and you know, you could see that post offices were struggling, but they were very, very important and very important to communities. And we consolidate the post offices. If there's three post offices in the Barra Peninsula losing money, if you close one and keep two open and those two then make money, you've done a good job. I always say that. The banks is very interesting because it's actually one of the things on post is it's kind of core to businesses now being able to change and digitize. So first of all, the banks retreat from their branch network. We are cash in society, and there is a government strategy on making sure there is cash available in society, and that's what the post office network is. It makes cash available. But it's also things like, you know, the HSE recently were sent a note to everybody in the HSE saying, oh, look, don't use post except for people who can only get letters or who aren't digitally connected, because it said they could save money, but it wasn't so much about that. It's they want to get people digitally connected. So do the banks. All of them can only do that because Unpost is providing a safety net, because Unpost will deliver those last letters. We will get to those last people. Now, I'm very keen that, you know, the last letter posted should cost 400 million euros because that's what a network costs for me. And you're not going to get... so the price of a stamp may go up further. But
how many letters are posted? What sort of numbers are we looking at now? How small is that market? How much has it diminished?
Well, it's diminished by 50% since I started. I don't take the blame for that, but it's diminished by 50%, which is the same as in the rest of Europe. We still deliver literally millions of letters every day. So, you know, it's still a very significant business. But the challenge for us is how we can make sure that we can make money from that side of the business to invest in the new areas of growth, which is e-commerce and parcels. And how can we invest? How can we grow? How can we invest in financial services?
And is a parcel just like a big letter?
A parcel is equivalent to, a normal size parcel is equivalent to about a million letters, you know, not a million, but certainly. I think we did a thing where we said it's about a 3,000 letters or something is for... is it the same? No. So we deliver parcels over the same network in some places. Other places, we have a different network for it. No, parcels are different in this way. letters are delivered on fixed routes, you know, so, and that's our obligation, our universal service obligation, and postmen and postwomen have to go by every house every day and deliver a letter. A parcel is dynamic. It's a parcel turns up. It's for Bobby Kerr in Dunleary, and we look at this, and every parcel is a surprise because we don't know what's coming in. Nobody tells us, and so we then have to deliver it, and we deliver it dynamically. So we will go out to you. It's not part of a route. So it's that's the essential difference.
Yeah.
Now, the other massive difference is the volumetrics, and we need to build some really major infrastructure in the next few years. We've done pretty well, but you know, the infrastructure we built in 2019 when we really getting serious about the parcel business, or 2018, was really to give us capacity to about 2025. Within a year, we because of COVID, we were at capacity.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've been over-trading every year since. It just means we have to throw bodies at it each Christmas. So we need to build out the capacity.
So in terms of the future of the business, if we were looking at financial services and related products versus parcels, is it an even split?
No. The post office business is the smaller business,
yeah.
And financial services just a part of it, but it's an important part of it, and it's something we want to grow, and we will grow, and we'll probably grow in partnerships, you know, and certainly that's our strategy now. And both businesses, both the post office business, delivery business, partnerships are absolutely vital. No, the delivery business is the bigger business, and it's also the one that is absolutely essential to the Irish economy. And, you know, as I'm constantly now saying to government, we're a trading company. You know, 30% of everything that comes into this country, everything, whether it's building supplies or anything, 30% goes through on post. And we know that from the customs declarations. And we're part of a worldwide, you know, the postal system is a worldwide system. And we've got to be very good at it.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is about making sure that Irish companies can trade globally and that Irish consumers can purchase globally. And in a world of trade wars and tariffs and everything, that gets increasingly complex. So if you go into the bowels of the Exo building here, what you will see are hundreds of people, hundreds of technologists and engineers. It's different to what people expect from Unpost.
Yeah.
This is a very, very technological business. The technology drives everything now.
Yeah. Interesting you mentioned COVID there, and this is a leadership podcast. I think it would be fair to say that Unpost showed great leadership during COVID. And that must be something you're very proud of.
I'm extremely proud of it. I mean, you know, but I couldn't have stopped it. That's the nature of the unique job that is a postman or postwoman's job, or indeed a postmistress in a post office. They just see public service. They just eat and drink it. But, you know, I think we worked out pretty early on. The Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, gave me a call and said, what can you do to help? Everybody's got to help. And I think we could see that in many ways we're the fourth emergency service. The AA used to have an ad, the fourth emergency service. We're the fourth emergency service. You know, we connect physically. And that physical connection, even if you just look at the recent storm, when there was no power and there was no phone service, how in God's name do you connect people?
Yeah.
Well, literally in a van going up and down a road. So during COVID, we very much said, just before COVID, we'd done some work in our brand and did the usual thing. What's our purpose? And we said our purpose is to act for the common good. And that's grand and everything. Boy, did it mean something during COVID. Everybody knew what to do. And I'm very, very proud of what the company did. It cost us a lot of money to keep every delivery route open. We were the only postal network in Europe that did that, kept every delivery route open, kept every post office open. And also, I think something unique about the Unpost brand, there's a kind of warmth to it. And so even something as simple as giving free postcards to everybody so they could send them to, you know, grandparents could send them to grandchildren,
yeah,
and lovers to each other and things like that. You know, those gestures are often as important as the really tough stuff, like keeping every delivery route open. And that's about being human, and it's about thinking of people. And some of that goes back to what I was saying earlier about women in the business, you know, who have a greater empathy for customers and really understand that.
Yeah.
And that helped inform a lot of that.
You mentioned earlier as well, David, the Dublin Task Force. Again, tell us a little bit about that. We there's certainly a view that the city, the capital city, as we know it, has never really recovered from COVID. It was shut down effectively, and a lot of, I suppose, the things that kept it alive were displaced.
Well, it was a bit like, you know, Tim Worstone put me in a plane to Boston. I got a call from the Taoiseach asking me to do his task force, but I had absolutely no idea what it was, and I'm not sure he particularly knew what it was, but people knew that we have to do something to really fix Dublin. You're absolutely right, the city's never recovered. It's half the number of people come into the city that used to come into the city. And but pretty quickly, through Department Taoiseach, worked out, let's get the agencies together, you know, whether that be the HSE or the guards and the transport, the council and Board Fáilte. And anyway, I got a group of about, I think we were 12 people in the task force. And within 3 months, we'd been through every report that had been done in Dublin. We'd met pretty much everybody who had an interest in it. And we came up with a report that I think is, you know, I think it stands up internationally. I know that through urbanists I work with in London and elsewhere. It is 12 big moves, or sorry, 10 big moves for Dublin. And it's a very clear, focused plan that's holistic. You know, an example, one of the things that people often say about Dublin, we need more guards. And yes, we do need more guards. And the plan says we need 1,000 more guards. But you can't just put more and more guards in the street and turn it into a garrison town. What actually makes people feel safe is people living in a city, yeah, seeing people in a city. So having people living above the shop is really important. Having some high density residential in the city centre is important. We introduced the idea of the essential workers programme, which now Google picked up, of all people, which was amazing that they've done it, you know, to provide apartments in town for people who work in town. So I'm actually off after this interview to the Department of Taoiseach just to catch up, because I've been away for a few weeks, to catch up on where we are with the task force. It's got to happen. It's got to be implemented. Like everything in this state, we're a bit slow and we're a bit under calibrated.
And how do you feel about the second part of the job, which is the implementation?
I'm really enthusiastic, really enthusiastic.
And what sort of teeth do you have, or what sort of influence can you bear?
Well, the only influence, you know, in a sense, the only influence I have is myself, you know, and to be able to talk to people about it and try and persuade people about it. And that, in the end, is the influence that any of us have. I think that the issue is so serious in relation to how the city is that government has no choice but to get it to happen. And I think they will get it to happen. And, you know, I know there's a group within government that is drawing up the implementation. And I'm very keen for that to happen. The issue really is a team needs to be established. You know, it's all about leadership in the end. A team needs to be established. I think also something really important to me, it will sound trivial, but it's been so important to me throughout my career. We need a really serious marketing function for Dublin. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows what's going on in Dublin. There's no pride in Dublin. You know, there's a latent pride, but there's no real pride in Dublin at the moment. People don't know what's going on often. They don't see some of the improvements that are made. The city actually is doing a lot better than people think. And so we need to market Dublin to Dubliners to get more people, because it's a vicious circle. If people don't come into town, then fewer people come in and people feel unsafe. People come in, more people come in and feel safe. And it's so we really need to get that communication right with people in Dublin, but also internationally. We need to bring in international money. You know, we need money. We need developer money. And then, of course, the massive elephant in the room is our shocking planning system. And it is shocking. And that's where really government needs to totally turn over the planning system. Now, there's a lot of emphasis on the new Planning Act. I'm not sure that's going to do it, because I think that's just part of it. I think there's cultural issues. There's issues about people, you know, I talk about acting for the common good. We've forgotten what that is. The amount of really brilliant developments that are objected to on relatively trivial grounds is just so dismaying. And often objected to by people who will then go on radio and say, oh, isn't it dreadful that young people can't get a home?
So
I'm pretty keen that we push on with this. But look, it's not my day job. There are some good people around, but I will certainly do whatever I can to help bring it to life and make it happen.
So what sort of leadership is required, do you think, just to close it out, in terms of bringing it to doing real work, tangible work that makes the city a better place?
It's possible. I'm in favour of an elected mayor, but only if the mayor has the budget, and the mayor has to be given the budget.
Yeah.
And and you can set up a prototype coordination office. There's good people in the council who can do that. And you could put together a group from the task force, just a smaller group, and it could be done. It's not, a lot of it isn't that difficult. It's the decision to get there that seems to be difficult. So, and then a leader, you know, it needs to have an independent chair, whether that be somebody like me or whoever, needs to have an independent chair. And then it needs to have the budget to make the changes happen.
Yeah.
I'm very excited for it, because, you know, I'm in the start of this journey of learning about urbanism, but everything I've learned about it suggests that, you know, the North Inner City could become one of the most happening neighbourhoods in Europe, because it's neighbourhoods which have been neglected that can turn around fastest, because there's derelict property, because the local community are much more in favour of change. Yeah. And getting things to happen. So, you know, I'm very hopeful, but I'm also very nervous that if these big steps aren't made within the next 6 months, then there really will be trouble, because you can't have false moves, you know, and this is a serious move. One of the things that was said about the task force, which actually I'm very proud of, people go, but a lot of this has been said before, and I'm going, exactly. You know, my whole point was just not to go reinventing everything.
Yeah.
There's some new stuff in it, but it's really sensible, strong urban building and urban regeneration.
Right. What about what's next for you, Davis, in terms of, have you another leadership gig in you when you finish your term on post?
My term finishes in 18 months, or a bit less, 15 months, I think. So I'll see what's out there. Yeah,
yeah.
I certainly feel energized to do something. I'm not necessarily sure it'd be absolutely full time, but I'd very much like to see the changes happen for Dublin. In Dublin, I'd like to be part of that somehow. I'm really into urbanism in a big way. But, you know, I love business as well. I love any business.
Yeah.
And most businesses are fascinating when you get into them. You know, I often say to MBA students or things, they ask for advice, and I'd say, take the rubbish job, because, you know, don't go in after Alex Ferguson. Take the rubbish job, because...
much
more opportunity, like going into the railway station stores. You know, that's where the opportunity is. So I'd look at anything.
Yeah, yeah. And then when we think then about... leaders who've inspired you. Any thoughts there?
Well, there's loads. Tony O'Reilly was a great leader, just because of the sheer charisma. I think Tim Waterstone is my personal champion.
Is he still alive?
He's still alive.
Yeah.
And he's an incredibly nice man. And he taught me a few things about business. First was this incredible sense of... that almost, I don't like using the word mission or vision, but a sense that you do something because it's worthwhile. And for him, it was about getting great books everywhere, that
yeah.
you could really make books available to people. And, you know, he was more interested in opening bookstores in Bradford than he was in Hampstead,
yeah.
you know, and to places to get books out, and always absolute believer in quality, the highest quality for customers. And so I found that really inspiring. But maybe it was more personal stuff, which is just a very nice man. And I've learned, you know, I've been tough and driven in my career, and sometimes too tough and too driven, and probably unfair on some people in my career. But certainly as I'm getting towards the later stages of it, it's just be nice. Just get on with people. And don't be cynical. You know, the one thing that I make sure never happens any business I'm around is there can be no room for cynicism, because that destroys cultures. But just be nice. And Tim, I think, really had that mix of being driven around a purpose that matters, but also being just being nice with it.
He also, as you alluded to earlier, trusted you when he sent you to the States and told you to just open up the shop. So his leadership obviously wasn't invasive, or he certainly didn't micromanage.
Actually, Bobby, I'm glad you said that, because actually that's the greatest lesson of him is, and I so believe it now, trust people around you. Find good people and trust them and let them get on with it.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm always amazed at how people want people to have loads of experience or something. I'm going, no, you need some experience. You don't need loads of experience. You need energy, commitment. You need the right attitude. And absolutely let people get on with it then, you know. And so, and in a sense, you know, maybe I've, you know, I know now I'm a good CEO, but it's taken me a bloody long time to get there in Unpust. And I certainly wish I'd been like this 20 years ago.
We do, as we all get on a bit older, I think we're a bit more reflective. We're a little bit more, I suppose we analyze things a bit more, and we don't just jump in as we would have in the early days. Impulsiveness is sort of driven out of us. But if you look back, and maybe can close out on this, if you look back at your 18-year-old self in Dundrum, about to head off to UCD, business was probably never really on your radar.
No, never was. And I wouldn't say it was on my radar until I probably started working with W.H. Smith. It wasn't, you know, as a bookseller was a different thing. You know, I do learn. I learn. My mother is a very practical person, and she's still alive, thank God. And she, you know, she's imbued that sense of practicality and getting on with things. My father was more on the intellectual side. And so I know in my life that if I don't have both of those things, an intellectual challenge and a practical challenge, I get unhappy or I get imbalanced. So, and I certainly didn't know that at the age of 18. You know, I wouldn't change that much in my life. I certainly would have gone somewhere else, not because I was nothing against UCD, but I wouldn't have lived at home in university. I had a happy time at home, but it wasn't the same thing. You don't get the same learning. I think I'd largely do the same things.
Yeah, well,
work hard, get up early in the morning and enjoy life.
Yeah. Well, listen, as always, David, it's a pleasure to chat to you. Thanks for being with us on Life and Leadership, and every success to you and to your family indeed for the future.
Thank you, Bobby.
Life and Leadership with Bobby Kerr.
A News Talk original.
Brought to you by Standard Life, a life savings company for your journey to and through retirement.